today. Jeremy Hunt says he is a great negotiator. Does his time as the country's longest-serving health secretary bear that out? And Dan Milmo on Deutsche Bank.
About 2 years ago, I was so worried about the prospect of Jeremy Hunt becoming the next Prime Minister. I had this eerie sense that it might happen, that I went onto Ladbrokes online and I placed my first ever bet in my life, and I put £20 on Jeremy Hunt at 50-1. So if he becomes Prime Minister, all my doctor friends and I are going to have a very well-stocked party where we're going to drink a lot of alcohol to drown our sorrows at this traumatic turn of events.
Jeremy Hunt is now the only man standing between Boris Johnson and number 10 Downing Street. He believes he's the only candidate who has been seriously tested in the kind of high-stakes political negotiations that come anywhere close to matching the Brexit talks.
As an entrepreneur and a cabinet minister who has spent his whole life doing negotiations, I am that person.
His biggest role in government so far was as the longest-serving health secretary the country has ever had. During that time, he successfully persuaded the Prime Minister to significantly boost NHS spending. But he was also mired in controversy as he forced a contract on junior doctors in the face of unprecedented industrial action. There are many in the NHS, like Rachel Clark, who are still really angry. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Jeremy Hunt and the NHS. Battle-hardened for Brexit or a man out of his depth? Dennis Campbell, you're the health policy editor here at The Guardian, and I just want to talk to you about Jeremy Hunt. I mean, he's had a fairly standard route into the Conservative Party. He was the son of a senior figure in the Navy, went to private school, PPE at Oxford, and then an entrepreneur before becoming the MP for South West Surrey in 2005. He very quickly moved into the shadow cabinet, and in 2010, under the coalition government, he became culture secretary. That was what he was doing when in 2012 they moved him to the Department of Health.
It's a huge task. It's the biggest privilege of my life. I'm incredibly honoured and very much looking forward to getting on with the job.
What was he walking into?
So Jeremy Hunt had the misfortune to inherit probably the biggest mess of an NHS reorganisation ever. He succeeded Andrew Lansley, the first Conservative Health Secretary in the coalition, who had the not-so-brilliant idea of doing a very, very, very radical, probably the most radical ever, revamp of the way the NHS in England is organised.
The profession is deeply suspicious when a government comes in and says they're not going to perform a major top-down reorganisation of the health service and then lands 353 pages on you.
It was so big and so radical and so far-reaching that the then Chief Executive of the NHS, David Nicholson, said you could see it from outer space. So Jeremy Hunt had to come in and sort that all out, and also to not let the NHS, which David Cameron in opposition in the run-up to the 2010 election had managed to kind of neutralise to an extent as an Achilles heel for the Conservatives, to try and make sure that the NHS didn't again become a real danger zone for the Conservatives to be in. So his mission was to keep the NHS quiet.
Were there other things that he had to deal with straight away?
The first big thing was the long-awaited report into the Mid-Staffordshire hospital care scandal, which arrived about 6 months into his tenure as health secretary.
The events at Stafford Hospital were a betrayal of the worst kind, a betrayal of the patients, of the families, and of the vast majority of NHS staff who do everything in their power.
It showed that people had died as a result of poor care at Stafford Hospital. And Jeremy Hunt then went on a real mission to make improving patient safety the raison d'etre of his tenure as health secretary.
It's not just me that wants to improve patient safety in the NHS. Every week, you know, horrible to say, but we operate on the wrong part of someone's body.
Jeremy Hunt had come in to kind of improve relations between the government and the medical profession, but that didn't seem to be going that well.
One of the paradoxes of Jeremy Hunt's record tenure as Health Secretary, even before the junior doctors' dispute blew up, he had already managed to completely antagonise all of the nation's hospital consultants, so the senior doctors who work in hospitals, and also pretty much all of the nation's GPs by, in different ways, portraying them as people who didn't work long enough, hard enough, diligently enough, professionally enough. I think it's an element of his personality that he likes a scrap.
Do you remember the first time that Jeremy Hunt appeared on your radar?
Yes.
Rachel Clark was a junior doctor when Jeremy Hunt tried to impose a new contract that would seriously affect working conditions. She's now a specialist working in palliative care.
I paid no attention to Jeremy Hunt as Health Secretary until a very specific moment. In July 2015, Jeremy Hunt gave a speech in which he accused doctors of unprofessionalism.
Around 6,000 people lose their lives every year because we don't have a proper seven-day service in hospitals. You are 15% more likely to die if you're admitted on a Sunday compared to being admitted on a Wednesday.
It was a deliberately, aggressively worded speech. It was antagonistic, it was accusatory, it was bombastic, and he directly impugned my profession.
No one could possibly say this was a system built around the needs of patients. And yet, when I pointed this out to the BMA, they told me to get real. I simply say to the doctors' union that I can give them 6,000 reasons why they, not I, need to get real on this.
Where were you watching it?
I read the coverage of that speech in the early hours of the morning. And unfortunately, my very young daughter at the time had wet the bed, as toddlers do. So I'd sorted her out, then checked my phone and made the fatal mistake of looking at the BBC News headlines. And I read this speech at 3 o'clock in the morning and I didn't sleep a wink for the rest of that night. I was so shocked and appalled that a health secretary would attack doctors in this way. It was a deliberate attack. The front pages of the press had headlines like Hunt goes to war with doctors. And when I went to work the next day in the doctor's mess, I was with my little team of fellow doctors, and all of us consultants, juniors, were saying, my God, this is unbelievable how he's attacked us, implying to the public that doctors were either too lazy or too money grabbing to work at weekends. Was a lie. It was a misrepresentation of the truth.
The new contract was complex, but basically aimed to remove overtime so doctors would be expected to work antisocial hours, but more often and without extra money, providing the seven-day idea without more funding.
Instead of being honest and upfront with the profession and with the public and saying, look, I just want to save money on the staff here, you know, at least that would have had some kind of integrity to it. It would have been honest. Instead of doing that, he insisted that his new contract, which was going to do away with that system of paying us, was going to make us safer, even though we had the same number of doctors, no extra staff at weekends, just stretch us more thinly.
What really frustrated you about his behaviour?
Yeah, well, it's funny, isn't it? Because at the moment, Jeremy Hunt has made a big song and dance of accusing Boris Johnson, his rival, of cowardice because he won't debate him. And that's pretty rich when you hear that from the perspective of being a junior doctor. Throughout the dispute, Jeremy Hunt did something that drove us wild. He constantly said to the media,
well, the door is open anytime.
And my door is always open to junior doctors. And yet, in the whole history of human doors, no door was ever as slammed shut as Jeremy Hunt's. He was terrified of us. He wouldn't dare be in a recording studio with a junior doctor. I know that because multiple times I asked him to talk with me, a random junior doctor, but he was too scared.
And did you try to speak to him directly?
So we got to a stage in the dispute where we were going to undertake the first ever all-out doctor strike in NHS history. So even emergency services, we were going to withdraw our labour from. None of us wanted to do that. We really, I couldn't bear the thought of doing that. And I really didn't want to go on strike in that way. But Jeremy Hunt, at this point in the dispute, refused to go back to the negotiating table. So I decided if he wasn't going to come to a recording studio, I would go to him. Myself and a fellow junior doctor, we walked up to the Department of Health and we walked through Jeremy Hunt's famously open door and said, "We're here to talk to Jeremy Hunt." He says his door was always open to junior doctors. "Here we are. Can we speak to him, please?" Unsurprisingly, the Department of Health went into meltdown and a very senior security man ushered us out, whereupon we set up a trestle table with a tablecloth that said, "Time to talk, Jeremy."
What are you going to say to him that he hasn't already heard?
Well, I'm not sure he has heard anything of substance from grassroots junior doctors, because in spite of claiming multiple times that his door is always open to us, to our knowledge, he hasn't met with a single one of us since this dispute began last summer. And we stayed there for the next 24 hours. We camped outside the Department of Health on his doorstep all night and all day, waiting for Jeremy Hunt to talk to us. I'm depressed to say that in all the time we camped outside his doorstep, Jeremy Hunt used an underground entrance at the back of the Department of Health to go into his own department. He was that scared of talking to us. From then onwards, in our peaceful protest, for a month, we had two junior doctors outside the Department of Health, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And in that entire time, not only would Jeremy Hunt not talk to us, he continued to scuttle around the back entrance, the underground tunnel into the Department of Health. NHS, save
our NHS! The new contract doesn't have the safeguards in place that we currently have.
The fact that now working at sort of like 10 p.m. on a Saturday is going to be the same as working like 3 p.m. on a Tuesday, you know, I don't agree with.
How did the dispute resolve?
The dispute resolved in a total victory, in inverted commas, for Jeremy Hunt. He imposed his contract. He forced junior doctors to go on to that contract. And I'm sure he was popping bottles of champagne in the Department of Health. To my mind, though, he may have won the battle, but he most definitely lost the war, because the effect on morale was so catastrophic of that dispute. We felt so broken and undermined and really desperate throughout and after that dispute.
We've spoken to Rachel Clark. She really, really, really didn't like him, doesn't like him. How representative is that? I mean, are there junior doctors out there who are like, "Yeah, Jeremy Hunt, he was all right"?
Rachel Clark is typical, a representative of the anger that junior doctors felt so strongly and widely at the time. And those reverberations continue. Jeremy Hunt still has a very bad name, understandably, amongst junior doctors.
Some would say Jeremy Hunt had an almost impossible task when it came to junior doctors. Do you feel sorry for him?
Actually, don't have any sympathy for Jeremy Hunt, not at all. I think he took junior doctors for mugs. I think psychologically he probably misread them. He probably thought they're young and inexperienced. They're at the start of their careers. They'll put up with anything, because junior doctors generally do put up with anything. That's the way it's always been. Long hours, bullying culture, little rest, disruption to your social life and your work-life balance, etc. And I think he miscalculated on a grand scale. If you want to have a proper, full-functioning NHS across all 7 days of the week equally, you needed more money and more staff to do it properly. He didn't offer that.
And in the end, he survives it all.
In the end, Jeremy Hunt would say that in the end, he won. It became a very, almost an old-fashioned 1970s-style industrial dispute where both he personally, as the cabinet minister, and the government more widely, couldn't be seen to lose with the junior doctors. So they had to win, so he imposed the contract.
Is there any part of the dispute with junior doctors that could be seen as a positive?
I think it shows that he has the ability to get something done, even if a lot of people disagree with it. The point of all of this became slightly lost because the government, in effect, quietly jettisoned the whole seven-day NHS as its main NHS policy. Theresa May, when she became as Prime Minister, she wasn't so keen on that. It was associated with David Cameron. There were clearly practical problems with it. And so it's arguable now whether or not the junior doctors' dispute and all of the heat and light and controversy that generated was actually worthwhile.
So in January 2018, Theresa May was planning a reshuffle. I was political editor at the time, so I was actually covering it. And we all thought he was going to be shuffled over to business and Greg Clark was going to come to help. What actually happened?
Jeremy Hunt, when he was health secretary, always wore a blue and white NHS lapel badge in his left lapel. When he took his walk up Downing Street the day of that messed up reshuffle, he didn't have it in his buttonhole. And everyone thought, that's a symbol that he knows he's out. And that seemed to confirm what rumours that were circulating on social media and reports on websites that day, that he was out. Then,
Mr. Hunt, are you more powerful than the Prime Minister?
In the room, apparently, he simply refused to be sacked.
Because Jeremy Hunt refused the Prime Minister's attempt to move him yesterday, and he stays at health.
He said, I'm not going to go. I'm certainly not going to go quietly. And anyway, Prime Minister, I've got this plan that if you keep me, I'll sort out the NHS and I'll also sort out social care. And then he walked out a little while later, smiling, lapel badge back in, with a newly expanded remit, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. And he'd won.
Okay, so he moves into another phase as Health Secretary. Mm. The contract has gone. The seven-day NHS has literally gone. And what does he want to do now?
So they say leopards don't change their spots, but actually Jeremy Hunt, I think, did in a really, really important way. So from about the middle of 2017, I began picking up from senior doctors, senior NHS people, senior health think tank people who would have sort of private conversation with them, that the extent of the problems in the NHS, what the media across the board were typically referring to as the NHS crisis, that he really, really got that the NHS was in a really bad place and it was in serious danger of ruining Conservative election prospects. What was interesting, I think, about Hunt was that he then began trying to persuade the Prime Minister, both publicly and privately, to give the NHS a, in relative terms, massive increase in its budget, a massive relative to the 1% a year it had from 2010 onwards, and to tie this in with the NHS's then imminent 70th birthday in July 2018. He did this by getting all of the medical groups, the health think tanks, all sorts of independent bodies to present. He encouraged them to come out with evidence showing that the NHS was in a bad way, that it needed an awful lot of money quite quickly. He freelanced a bit. The Theresa May's authority was obviously was crumbling fast at the time, but Jeremy Hunt quite deliberately did several media interviews in which he basically freelanced on health policy. He said, for example, we need a long-term budgetary settlement for the NHS, not a settlement covering 1, 2, or 3 years. He said the NHS needs to be given real terms increases, i.e. more than inflation, which was completely anathema. And this kind of, he was deliberately stirring the pot and trying to force Theresa May to do what, strangely, ironically, every health think tank, every expert, every Save the NHS campaigner roughly thought was needed, which was a lot more money, fast and for the long term.
And he got it.
And he got it. And he got it in the face of trenchant opposition from the Chancellor and the Treasury, who did not want to commit very large sums of money to what was already the government's biggest spending department. But he got 3.4% a year, every year, for the 5 years, including the one we're in now.
Jeremy Hunt thinks he can be Prime Minister at a time that Britain faces a really tough negotiation. And even if he's beaten by Boris Johnson, he'll probably have a very senior cabinet role. But it sounds to me like there are two distinct things that he did at the Department of Health. Quite differently, he imposed a contract on junior doctors in quite a brutal way that really lost him the trust of the medical profession. And then he appeared to try and build a consensus across the industry or across the health service to try to persuade the Chancellor to give more money to the NHS. Do either of those tell us whether or not he is a good negotiator?
I think if he becomes Prime Minister, the real Jeremy Hunt will have to stand up, particularly in the context of Brexit and what follows. Because if he deploys the skill set that he did with the junior doctors, that will get him nowhere domestically, and particularly in terms of Brexit and foreign affairs. But if he rediscovers and relies upon the sort of different skills he displayed in persuading Theresa May to give the NHS a lot of money, and that he's showed, certainly in his time as Foreign Secretary, it'll be better for him, better for the government, and better for the country. But he needs to work out which is the real Jeremy Hunt and show us it.
Jeremy Hunt has been praised for securing more money for the NHS at a time of massive cuts elsewhere, but he will not be able to shake from his legacy the anger of many doctors like Rachel Clark.
Jeremy Hunt forevermore will be known as the health secretary who went to war with decent, hard-working, committed NHS staff. The trouble is, to try and position yourself as a patient safety champion because you're changing culture while literally presiding over an NHS in which patients are dying on trolleys in corridors, cancer waits are the worst they've ever been, A&E waits are appalling, 4.3 million people now are on NHS waiting lists. You cannot pretend that you have improved patient safety.
Okay, so you definitely don't want Jeremy Hunt as Prime Minister. What about Boris Johnson?
Honestly, I think that that is like asking me, would I prefer syphilis or gonorrhea? Really, there's no choice. They are both pretty horrific and painful and likely to stick around potentially for a long time. And that's not good for the country.
Rachel, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
We put the allegations made by Rachel Clark to Jeremy Hunt. His team said they did not agree with the analysis, but they did highlight his recent comment looking back at the junior doctor dispute with some regrets. He said, "As health secretary, I did have some very stubborn battles. And in particular, in the battle I had with the junior doctors, I don't think I was as good at communicating my vision as I should have been. They are wonderful people, and that is the thing I learned from that. Be better at communicating what you want to do." Do follow Dennis Campbell's brilliant coverage of health policy at theguardian.com. Coming up, a crisis at Deutsche Bank costing 18,000 jobs worldwide. Now, on Sunday, the German-owned Deutsche Bank announced that it would be radically restructuring and cutting 20% of its workforce. In the City of London, the bank is one of the biggest employers, but it's also an organisation that struggled to recover from the financial crash and has had to pay heavy fines after a series of scandals. Dan Milmo is The Guardian's Deputy Business and Consumer Editor.
The City of London's seen a lot of grim days over the past 10 years. Monday was another of them. Deutsche Bank is a big German institution, but it's a very important part of the square mile, as we call it. It's a big institution in the UK. And on Monday, about 10 a.m, they announced a massive restructuring plan to staff that will result in many, many redundancies here in the UK, where they employ 8,000 people. So it was a shocking day for those staff. We saw reports of people leaving in tears, people going to the pub early, you know, one trader saying, "Where else would I go?" And it's probably going to rumble on for a bit yet. You would have seen the same in New York as well, where they had a big investment banking operation until Monday. Deutsche Bank is a big name. It's a big institution in the Eurozone's largest economy, Germany. It's just failed to live up to that billing for many years now because it made a series of errors, a series of serious errors in the financial crisis. For instance, it had to pay a fine of about $7 billion for the issuing of what, you know, the esoteric term is mortgage-backed securities, but it's just dodgy housing debt, which helped bring down the financial system. They've been deemed to be quite slow in cleaning up their corporate reputation. They've also been censured for their role in failing to prevent Russian money laundering. It remained a big German institution that was trying to go toe-to-toe, as it were, with the likes of Goldman Sachs, the big investment banks. And what happened on Monday, finally, Deutsche Bank said, OK, we need to cut back. We need to not be this big globe-straddling giant that we think we were, because they certainly are not. The cuts are going to happen over a period of years. So it won't be everyone out on the street with their cardboard boxes overnight. But yes, 20%. It's a big number, but it also reflects how much Deutsche Bank has left undone over the past 10 years. Deutsche Bank's announcement yesterday is going to result in an economic hit for the London economy, but also it's not related to Brexit, and Brexit is going to be the big thing that's going to affect the City of London and financial services across the UK. So the fear would be that the impact that some Deutsche Bank former employees are feeling today is going to be replicated on a much bigger scale in years to come. In terms of the people exiting their jobs from Deutsche Bank, will be applying for jobs in institutions that are on a bit of a lockdown because they don't know where Brexit is going. So this could be a litmus test for the contraction that we're probably going to see in financial services in the UK for years to come.
That was Dan Milmo. Follow his reporting and the rest of our business team on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Dennis Campbell, Rachel Clark, and Dan Milmo. This episode was produced by David Waters, Nicola Kelly, India Rackerson, Courtney Youssef, and with additional research by Kate Kulnietze. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.